The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think with the Trump administration, it's hard to tell because there have been these kind of irresponsible skinny budgets that are released that it's hard to tell how serious of a policy document those are versus just an attempt to make a strong case about fiscal austerity. And in many cases, involve dramatic slashes to the State Department's budget, increases to the Pentagon budget, although not always clear that it's in the most strategic way. And then Congress takes a pretty active role in kind of reshaping it into what they think it ought to look like. And so, I haven't seen a really frank and I think honest budget conversation with this administration yet that really lays out our resources and how they're going to help us accomplish a range of national security objectives, including but not limited to counterterrorism.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, May 29th, 2018. In January 2017, Donald Trump inherited a complex, multifaceted counterterrorism campaign. And since taking office, he has escalated it both rhetorically and operationally. On Tuesday, New America convened a panel of Josh Geltzer and Luke Hartig, both former senior directors for counterterrorism on the Obama National Security Council, Stephen Tankel, a professor at American University, and Shamila Chaudhry, former director for Pakistan and Afghanistan on the National Security Council. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 316. Counterterrorism under the early Trump administration.
Okay, so we're going to start with Stephen. First, congratulations on the book. In it, you outline problems with the current U.S. approach, some longstanding and then some that are unique to Trump. And in other writings, you've acknowledged that there's been a change in how the Trump administration is pursuing terrorism or countering terrorism, but it's not really clear what their strategy is. Yeah. We see tactics in the news, but we're not actually sure why they're doing them, and they haven't explained themselves. So I thought it would be good to start with you to kind of give us a scene setter of some of these topics of use of force, direct action, how they've evolved, and how they've involved kind of our partners, how they've shaped our partnerships, and what you see happening today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, and thank you to New America for hosting this. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to be up here with three friends, who I've worked with in one capacity or another. And I should also note that, while I wrote the book from an academic perspective, it was very much informed by a brief time that I spent working at DOD as well. I'd gone in thinking that I was going to write a book that looked more at the threat side of the picture. And when I was working a lot on Afghanistan-Pakistan issues at OSD policy, I was really struck by the ways in which our partner nations can be absolutely critical to what we're trying to accomplish, but also incredibly frustrating, which I think is an understatement when talking about countries like Pakistan, for example. And so that was really formative for me to come out and rethink the kind of book that I was writing. So diving in on your question, Shamila, in terms of how we've seen direct action evolve and what it looks like under Trump and what the implications may have been for partnerships, when we're talking about direct action, just so everybody's on the same page, we're talking about counterterrorism strikes, counterterrorism raids, airstrikes, drone strikes, outside of areas of active hostility. So we're not, just to put us all on the same page, not going to be talking about what's happening in places like Iraq or Afghanistan, where the United States has had larger military presence. Talking more about countries like Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya. Going back to even the Bush administration, there was use of special operations forces for counterterrorism raids drone strikes are used relatively sparingly. There's one in Yemen in 2002. There's, I think, a total of 14 in Pakistan from 2004 through the summer of 2008. And it's in June of 2008 when there's a large escalation after Bush is informed and shown evidence of the Pakistani intelligence service and military supporting the Haqqani network, which is fighting U.S. forces in Afghanistan, supporting them directly. There's a large uptick, and we get over 30 drone strikes between June 2008 and the end of the year. Technological advancements in UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, as well as the creation of a independent intelligence network in Pakistan, independent of Pakistani intelligence, helps enable that escalation, even if it's not sort of the cause for it. Obama comes into office and inherits those capabilities. And it's under Obama that we see, I would say, a radical expansion of the use of direct action, especially in the form of drone strikes, and most notably in Pakistan, where the majority of them occur. I think it's important to put that escalation in context. When Obama comes in, he makes working by, with, and through partner nations a cornerstone of his counterterrorism strategy. And there's more emphasis and money behind building partnership capacity, and not just for military capabilities, but also trying to promote development, governance, rule of law, things like that. And the intention is to get partners to share the costs and the risks of U.S. counterterrorism, but it's also beyond burden sharing to try to make counterterrorism more sustainable on the ground, which is to say that military gains can be ephemeral. By getting partners to buy in, you give host nations more legitimacy, and you help build patterns of cooperation and give them the capabilities and capacity that they're going to need to solidify those military gains over the longer term. So this isn't just about burden sharing, although there is a component of it. Yet at the same time, while Obama is trying to do more to work by, with, and through partners, he's also prepared to work around them when necessary. And Pakistan, Shamil, as you in particular will know, but Josh and Luke also, I'm sure, are imminently familiar, is an example of a partner where they are not willing or able to execute counterterrorism operations on the ground against terrorists that threaten the United States directly. And so drone strikes enable working around Pakistan. They're also used in Yemen, where you have another problematic government. But while drone strikes enable working around governments, they also raise questions about the use of lethal force outside of areas of active hostilities. And in 2013, the United States puts in place a framework to govern that use of force, the PPG, Presidential Policy Guidance. I think, Luke, you're going to dig more into the guts of that. So I'll just highlight very quickly a couple points before moving to Trump and then finishing up with a little more of a discussion of the implication of partners and some of the changes of direct action. One is that the country where you're using direct action either needs to consent to the use of direct action or be unwilling or unable to address the threat themselves. Pakistan certainly qualifies. Not only unwilling or unable legally, but also it gave its consent for most drone strikes. And there needs to be a continuing imminent threat to the United States of the individuals who are being targeted in those strikes. So that's the framework that that is put in place. By the time Obama is leaving office, however, the threat has evolved, right? The PPG is a product of its time. ISIS has not burst on the scene, and you haven't had the civil wars, really sort of come to fruition out of the Arab uprisings at the time. And there's an expansion of the way in which direct action is being used by the end of Obama's term, not just to work around difficult partners, but also to support partner forces on the ground. So, for example, Libya is declared an area of active hostilities so that the United States can use drone strikes in support of partner forces on the ground against ISIS. This is the world that Trump inherits. Reportedly, as of 2017, the PPG has been replaced with principles, standards, and procedures, a new framework. It's not as transformative as it could have been. I think my colleagues are going to talk about that. So again, I'll just highlight two quick things. One is that it removes the continuing imminent threat standard to U.S. persons, right? So previously, United States couldn't kill a courier if that courier didn't pose a threat, right? Couldn't kill a financier if that financier didn't pose a direct threat. Now it can. Second, devolves authority downward. So proposed strikes, counterterrorism raids don't undergo the same high level of vetting. What's the impact on our partnerships of these changes? First, there are some potential benefits. Right? There are tactical advantages to removing the imminent threat standard, both from a straightforward USCT perspective, but also in that the United States can now support partner forces on the ground to a greater extent. And if you're asking your partners to go and fight these fights and carry the lion's share of the load, then being able to support them has benefits. Streamlining the oversight process also enables us to be more nimble and responsive to our partners. But these benefits at the same time come with potential costs. The first is, although drone strikes enable us to work around partners or to support them, they also create other forms of dependence. You heard me say earlier that you need consent or you need a partner to be unwilling or unable to address the threat. That's the legal threshold. The policy threshold is higher. Luke and Josh can both speak to this with sort of much greater detail and I'm sure clarity than I can. But my understanding is you really don't want to do a drone strike in somebody's territory without their consent unless you absolutely have to. And so you're dependent on host nations for access. Of course, you also need bases for drones. You need logistical support. You need intelligence support, which means you're dependent on other countries to help support drone strikes as well. The danger of relying more on them, right, or of lowering the threshold for using direct action, one of the dangers is that operational requirements for drone strikes increasingly crowd out the other elements of counterterrorism that the United States should be focusing on. Second, by removing the continuing threat standard, there is the risk that some of those other states that support direct action are necessary to support direct action but don't sort of sign on to this idea of a global campaign against Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are less willing to provide that support. And then, of course, there's always the risk of blowback. That's something that's been longstanding. We're seeing more partnered operations where U.S. Special Operations Forces are working more closely with counterparts on the ground. We're lowering the standards for drone strikes so we can support our partners more. Without the right sort of vetting, without sober analysis, it I would argue, raises the potential for an errant strike that either hurts the United States directly or harms its relationship with a partner. And then finally, I would say the biggest problem is that none of this is happening in a vacuum. Trump's strategy, that agree that we can decipher it because we haven't seen anything published and they don't talk about this a lot, he personally appears to lean overwhelmingly on military-centric tools. And so this is happening while diplomats are being hobbled, while development experts are potentially being shut out. That sends a message to partner nations that the United States cares first and foremost about the military instrument, about killing terrorists, not about other aspects of counterterrorism. It raises potential risks that any military gains will be ephemeral because they won't be sustainable. And I will close with this, which is to say that direct action is an important part of any counterterrorism strategy for the United States, but it is not the only tool in the toolkit. And when it is used on its own or divorced from a political strategy, that is not a recipe for success. We've seen that in the past, in the early years of the Bush administration, when they were overly reliant on military tools, and we run that risk again. So could some of these changes that Trump is putting in place have operational benefits? Yes, they could. But only if they're married to a broader political strategy, and we haven't seen that as of yet. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Stephen. You did a really good job of kind of looking at some of the outcomes of the policy and the framework in practice, and I'd like Luke to take us back to kind of those conversations inside the government on what was the philosophy towards the framework and the, because whenever I look at policy, I think of three prongs to it. One is the intended purpose, and then two is the actual stated policy as it's defined, and then three is the implementation of it, right? So it's actually quite complex, and it is a very messy process on the inside, and once it exists, sometimes you feel like you don't have control over it. And that's why I think it's good to go back to what was the intended purpose of this. And so you spent a lot of time at the NSC working on Yemen and then in the CT office. And so I was hoping you could share some of that with us.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that's a really useful framework, those three phases. Before I jump into that, I just want to, again, commend to the audience Stephen's book. I do think it's an exceptional read. It is written with the rigor of a first-rate academic, which Stephen is, but also the prose, the penmanship is really that of a first-rate nonfiction writer. So kudos to Stephen on that book, and I hope you all pick it up. I was also just impressed with how much he wanted to understand the reality of policymaking, which I feel like was something that is often hard to find in academic books. So that's very useful. Back to the three-part framework that Shamila laid out, which I think is really useful in thinking about the drone policy, at least as was practiced in the Obama administration, and as best we can discern is how it's being implemented in the Trump administration. I worked on the development part of it at the Pentagon. The actual drafting of it somewhere between the Pentagon and the White House and the implementation at the White House, just to kind of orient my involvement in this. And I think if you think back and look at what the Obama administration was trying to accomplish, it's helpful to think of kind of where the world of counterterrorism was at the time that the presidential policy guidance or the PPG was developed and ultimately rolled out. President Obama comes in, very clear guidance that we need to focus on the right war. The right war, as it were, is both Afghanistan as well as the broader fight against al-Qaeda. It's not a global war on terrorism. It's a war against al-Qaeda, its affiliates, and its adherents. And he enters that war with the capabilities from the military and from the intelligence community that have been refined over the past 7 years, mostly in the Iraq theater, but also in the Afghanistan theater. And so we have highly developed special operations forces, highly developed ways of actually identifying and tracking terrorists, and then the emerging drone technology, which is actually developed quite a bit at that point, and gives us a lot of capability to go after and conduct targeted strikes against those who would do us harm. And so the theaters kind of emerge accordingly, right? We're going all in on Afghanistan, we've got the surge, and then in other theaters, particularly places like Yemen and Somalia, we're ratcheting up this kind of hybrid warfare where we're providing some training and assistance to folks on the ground. And we're also accompanying that with drone strikes as may be appropriate. The world ends up in many ways looking far more bipolar than I think it is today. And so let me just unpack that a little bit because I want to come back to that as I continue these remarks. You have, on the one hand, kind of an Afghanistan or Iraq-like theater. That's to say it's full-scale combat operations. We have U.S. forces engaged in the fight against the enemy. When you're in that context, a warlike framework is really what's applied. You have to, of course, abide by the principles of precision and discrimination and the other principles that underlie the law of armed conflict. But at the same point, when you have U.S. forces in conflict with the enemy, you're willing to loosen the reins a bit in order to make sure that they have everything that they need and all of the use of force that they need in order to successfully accomplish their mission and in order to beat back enemies when they are particularly under siege from the enemy. In a place like Yemen around, say, circa 2010, 2011, where you have some significant state fragility, to be sure, but you still have a mostly stable central government with something approximating an insurgency in the countryside, that framework looks very different from actual U.S. full-scale combat operations in Iraq or Afghanistan. And I think President Obama realized that and realized that while we might use some of the same capabilities and some of the same tools to go after terrorist threats in that Yemen and Somalia-like environment, the rules ought to be different because we're in a paradigm that looks much different than a full-scale major combat war. And so the rules that begin to emerge from that, these are things that evolve in place over time but are ultimately solidified and codified in the presidential policy guidance, focus on some big principles. First of all, let's define that area, those Yemens and Somalias, as something other than areas of active hostilities or outside areas of active hostilities. Let's say that there's a different set of rules that go into place in that location or those types of locations. Second of all, the president says, if we're in those locations, we're only going to take action against terrorist threats subject to a few specific conditions. The first of those is that the terrorist threat that we have identified poses a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. It's not a direct threat to U.S. interests. It is about U.S. people being in harm's way and about that threat being imminent and something that needs to be disrupted. Secondly, that action can only be taken if it can be assessed that capture is infeasible. So we've really looked at our ability to capture, our partner nation's ability to capture, other ways to minimize the threat, and we've determined that there's no other alternative. And thirdly, that there is near certainty that civilians will not be harmed in the strike or the operation that takes place, which is a very high standard, what President Obama felt was the highest standard he could set at that point in time and still be able to effectively go after the targets we needed to go after. And I think the final piece of it isn't something that's necessarily contained within the standards of the PPG, but is sort of a function of the entire document. And I think it gets at what Shamila was talking about, which is that the implementation piece is so important. And therefore, the PPG prescribes a pretty intensive interagency process for going over targets and making sure that when we're going to use direct action, we've made sure that the targets hit those certain imperatives and that we are fully aware, eyes wide open, and making good decisions around the foreign policy implications, around the implications for our intelligence collection, the full range of other foreign policy equities that might be implicated by taking direct action. So that is the framework. That is what President Obama puts forward in 2013 as kind of his best thinking on how to bound these types of operations and make sense of them. There are a few things that I think become problematic around these, and I think some of these Stephen alluded to, but I want to unpack them a little bit further because of the topic of Stephen's book, which is so timely around partnership and direct action, is directly implicated here. The first of which is, if you are going out and telling your partners that they are the answer, right? And indeed, a year after the speech that President Obama gave at National Defense University in 2014, he goes to West Point and says, okay, the centerpiece of our counterterrorism strategy going forward is partnerships. So if you go out and say, partnerships, we're the partnership guys, this is exactly what we want to do, we want to really invest in our partners, and then we tell our partners, but if you're facing threats, we're not necessarily going to be willing to use lethal force to protect you because you're not a U.S. person, well, you immediately run into a significant conflict between what you say your strategy is and what your policy on the use of force actually allows you to do. And it's a challenge, and it's something we kind of face coming right out of the gate. And it particularly becomes challenging because as we look at ways to be more effective in places like Yemen, in places like Libya, in places like Somalia, we find that often what we need to do are exactly the kinds of tactics that our military got so good at and have been so effective in working with our Iraqi and Afghan partners with. And that is that we are going to put more U.S. forces, more U.S. advisors out closer to the front lines. They're actually going to be advising partner forces, they're going to be providing them airlift, intelligence support, a full range of enablers that allow a partner force to actually be effective. And in some cases, that might need to include the use of force. It might need to include the use of force because those partner forces come under attack and we need to protect them. It might come into play because we want to help the partners by taking some offensive action prior to the partners going in there. And the PPG framework doesn't really fully allow for that. And so you see these exceptions that Stephen was talking about saying, well, part of Libya, particularly the campaign we're going to undertake against ISIS around Derna and Sirte, these are going to be kind of carved out from the PPG. And we're going to say these don't apply, the PPG framework doesn't apply. And so that works insofar as it allows us to take some of those actions to be more effective in tying our action to our stated partnership strategy. But it's also challenging for when you start to carve out some big loopholes in the framework, you start to wonder, well, is the framework really appropriate for what we're facing? And so the Trump administration comes into power, and the first thing they do is say, we're going to put all this stuff kind of on hiatus, on the back burner. For 6 months, we're going to say, the PPG doesn't apply. We have other types of rules. We don't know exactly what those rules are. All this we're sort of reading the tea leaves from the press. But we want military commanders to have the chance to be a little bit more forward-leaning and to come back and evaluate and develop a new framework. The framework that emerges, again, we don't actually know what this framework is because there have been no speeches about it. There's been no public rollout. What Stephen is talking about is mostly, I think, built off of reporting from the New York Times and from the Washington Post and other journalism outlets that have good sources on this. But it is something that gives a broader applicability and a loosening of the reins when it comes to being able to use direct action and support of partners, among other things. For those of us who worked on the Obama framework, the first reaction, I won't lie, is to be defensive, to say we had a good framework. Why did we throw that framework out? Why is the Trump framework, especially if you're upset about other things that the Trump administration is doing, this must not be the right framework. And yet, I do think it's important to ask, and it's worth asking at this point, and any prudent policymaker should ask, does the framework actually match the world we find ourselves in, both in terms of the threat as well as what we want to be able to do against the threat? And I don't know that the answer on that has been fully answered in a satisfactory way. And that's to say, when I talked earlier about the bipolar world of kind of a generally peaceful Yemen with a stable government and full-scale major combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, the polls on that in some ways have collapsed inward. What was previously full-scale combat operations in Afghanistan has turned into kind of a advise-assist mission on steroids. What we're doing in Iraq and Syria has always depended, at least since 2014, on really putting our partners out in the lead and us providing airstrikes and other support in order for them to be effective. And similarly, Yemen and Somalia and Libya have all kind of taken a slide backwards, and these theaters don't look like a stable yet somewhat fragile place. These look closer and more like Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria than they did before. And so I don't know that the old framework fully makes sense to govern those two places. But I think that's something that this administration should be working on, and any administration should. So I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you. Well, I'm going to have Josh answer a question and slash topic that you brought up, which is, you know, what is the current state of the world today when it comes to terrorism and security threats, and do the policies we have actually, like, work to address that? So, and Josh, you were also in the at the tail end of the Obama administration. You stayed some time for a little bit of time into the Trump administration. So I think you probably got some good perspective there, kind of on the mindset and the philosophy of the new team. How would you characterize what they're doing right now, even if it's not strategic and it's just tactical? I think it's worth explaining, not just to the Washington community, but to the American public, given, you know, every once in a while you'll see a news story of something that happens in Niger, and then Somalia, and then Yemen, and these are all kind of piecemeal kind of anecdotes, if you will, that, you know, you really have to work hard to put it together into a narrative. And so given your vantage point during that time, piece that together for us, and then walk us through how you see this war on terror, you know, as we knew it post 9/11, into the future. What should we be concerned about, and what kind of partnerships need to exist to actually get at those challenges?
Before answering the question, I will abuse the opening minute or so to add my thanks to you, to New America, for hosting this. And it's a particular treat to get to do this with two good friends. Stephen and I have been buddies since we were the lowest form of life, grad students together. But since then, I've very much admired his work, and I will echo Luke's sentiments. It's an excellent book, and I heartily recommend it. A lot of people talk about partnerships in counterterrorism, but to grapple with the trade-offs between counterterrorism and other foreign policy interests, and to dig into what partnerships actually can look like across the spectrum, Stephen's really done everyone who follows these issues a great service with the book.
Thank you.
And Luke has been a very generous colleague and friend since we got to work together in government and beyond. So it's fun to get to be up here with all three of you. Now, to actually answer your questions, or at least try. So I think the right place to start in talking about today's terrorist threat is still with ISIS in Syria. And I know there's an inclination to move on from that, in part because people want to talk about different things, in part because there is a generally good news story of that threat diminishing, but I still think it's the place to start. You have far fewer fighters, you have far less territory than ISIS held a couple years ago, or even a number of months ago, but you don't have that group eradicated, and that means you don't have the threat that it continues to pose eradicated. If anything, you have what seems to be something of a slowing down in the progress to squeeze that group, and thousands of fighters at least
enjoying something of an opportunity to figure out what comes next for them in the Euphrates River Valley region. I'll come back to kind of where the counterterrorism push is on that and what some of my thoughts are on the continuity versus a difference on that piece of it. I also think when you talk about today's threat, you stay in Syria, but you talk about Al-Qaeda in Syria. And this piece of Al-Qaeda, splinter group from Al-Qaeda, whatever you want to call it, has rebranded itself, renamed itself a number of times. I think it's easiest to think of it as the piece of Al-Qaeda that has now set up something of a haven in a different piece of Syria, more the northwest part of Syria, from where ISIS has now been cornered to some extent. And Al-Qaeda in Syria has been, in some ways, patient. It has, in some ways, played both the local and the regional as much, or probably prioritized that over sort of playing the global field. But I think it's perhaps a problem we will be talking about, a terrorist threat we will be talking about increasingly in time to come. That's not to say that other pieces of Al-Qaeda are gone, because they're not. There's still AQAP in Yemen. There's still Shabab in Somalia. And there's still Al-Qaeda's kind of original senior leadership, to the extent it remains, in the AFPAC region, though, to my mind, the center of gravity and even some of the real veterans of Al-Qaeda have shifted to northwest Syria over time. But I think you have these remnants that of both Al-Qaeda and ISIS, some diminishing, some actually surging a bit, or at least trying to. And beyond that, you still have, as you asked what we should worry about, you have the ability to reach in the United States and radicalize people here under whatever ideology a group wants to utilize. ISIS, of course, did this in a way that appeared to be more compelling than Al-Qaeda had been able to do previously, not just here in the U.S., but in Europe and elsewhere. It had this ability to make folks who were not on the battlefield with them, who might never go to the battlefield, somehow feel like they were part of the ISIS project and thus willing to kill and die in the name of that project. That's a remarkable thing, and I'm happy to spend time, and I know these folks have thoughts on as well what to do about it, but that problem hasn't gone away, and if anything, it's been revealed for others to try to utilize and iterate on and improve from their own vantage point. And finally, I would begin to think about what a terrorist group like ISIS that's losing key pieces of territory tries to do to maintain or regain momentum, and that's where this idea of novel cyber operations, of the type that counterterrorism folks have worried about for a while, that haven't really come to fruition yet, beyond the recruitment and radicalization there. You haven't seen working to bring down a power grid or to disrupt a hospital's operations. But you might, because there's clearly some technological expertise that ISIS has had, probably continues to have, and what they might turn to when they don't have the physical territory to plot and build networks and carry out the sort of operations they've unfortunately been able to carry out over the past few years, I would begin to think about that. Let me say a word just on the counterterrorism piece in relation to a few of those, and then I look forward to more of a discussion. You could tell different stories about the Trump administration's approach to some of these issues and whether there's continuity there or not. Let me start with the counter-ISIS campaign. You could tell a story of a strategy developed by the previous administration, well underway by the time you get to January 20 of last year, and that more or less continues. And I think that's very much to the credit of the Trump administration and to the Foreign Service officers and military personnel and intelligence community members, all those folks who are implementing it. A campaign on the ground in Iraq and Syria that has now retaken something close to 90-95%. You see somewhat differing estimates of the territory the group once held. That has clearly squeezed the group, pressured the group, and that sounds like a lot of continuity. It also sounds like a very good thing. On the other hand, you zoom out a little bit, and the pieces that go around counterterrorism don't look quite as tidy. They don't look quite as much defined by continuity. You look at the diplomacy that's critical to that campaign, and it starts to look a little bit shakier. Part of the reason that progress occurred and occurred as quickly as it did, and I think both Luke and Stephen reference this, is because the U.S. had capable counterterrorism partners on the ground. And in Syria, it was largely a force led by the Syrian Kurds. Those are the same folks whom one would hope would continue to clear ISIS from that pocket in the Euphrates River Valley that I mentioned earlier. But, and I say this in large part thanks to Eric's reporting on this, and I see him sitting in the back there, you have the Kurds largely turning away from that fight, going back to defend against Turkey and Afrin. Some of them may be trickling back to that fight, but if you don't get a ground force in the fight, you don't clear out what remain thousands of fighters. And diplomacy may not be what folks first think about when they think about counterterrorism, but it really matters. And those sorts of pieces don't seem to be exemplified by the same continuity that you might see in the operations themselves, in the military operations themselves. You don't see the holding together of the coalition quite as neatly, in part because of the more erratic diplomacy and messaging generally from this White House and from this administration more broadly. So there's a story that looks a little bit less defined by continuity as you zoom out from the strictly military counterterrorism piece. Let me put one other data point on the table for this, which is Libya. So towards the end of the Obama administration, you see the campaign that Luke mentioned to clear ISIS from Sirte, a coastal city where ISIS's level of control was really similar to what it had in Syria and Iraq at various points. You had you can find these images online. You had ISIS flags being marched down Main Street in parades in Sirte. Eventually, you have a campaign to clear the group from Sirte, again using largely American air power and key partners on the ground, local partners, partners affiliated with the GNA, the Libyan government, drawn largely from Misrata. And it looks, at least to my mind, like almost a paradigm by, with, and through partners counterterrorism operation, where the U.S. adds its comparative advantage and it has good partners on the ground, and it plans for the day after about what to do to make sure that this doesn't need to be repeated in an endless cycle of ISIS retaking the city and then the U.S. having to show up again to drop bombs to clear the group. And to some extent, you see in this administration some of the operations you would expect to see from any administration in the aftermath of that. Strikes against the group as it attempts to regather in the desert. In fact, the first of those strikes was on President Obama's last full day in office, and then you see more under this administration. So the pure military part seems like it has a lot of continuity. But then if you zoom out a bit, you see things that look less consistent. You see, first of all, less transparency with respect to these operations, both when they're occurring, where they're occurring, why they're occurring, and how they fit into a broader strategic approach to Libya. You also see less of an interest in the day after execution that I mentioned before. How is Sirte, a city that was really devastated by this group, being rebuilt so that it is more resilient as the group tries to retake it? And again, you see in the broader diplomatic context the lack of relationship building and diplomacy that could create for Libya writ large a more sustainable arrangement where Libyans can do the counterterrorism to the extent that needs to be done going forward. So I'll leave on that note, which is to say that in some ways, it's the level of generality at which you want to talk about counterterrorism and how partnerships fit into counterterrorism that gives you a somewhat different answer as to where we are, how similar it looks to where we were before, mm-hmm. and how effective things seem to be right now.
Just a couple of comments, and then I want to do another follow-up question with all of you, and we'll open it up. One thing I think we definitely learned kind of from the beginning of the Obama administration till the end is that good counterterrorism policy is not just about counterterrorism, which all of you alluded to, right? And it's also not an approach that is restricted to any one government agency. It's a whole of government approach if you want it to be successful and sustainable. And I think that's definitely something we learned by the end of it. And one would hope that that's something that is shared with the next administration, whoever they may be, and that gets built upon. And there's always some kind of dismantling of policy because that's what every government needs to distinguish itself. But one would think and hope that we would maintain that whole of government approach because without it, I don't think we get at kind of the foundational issues of why terrorism is allowed to persist in some of these countries. It's not just about the fact that there are non-state actors doing whatever they want. A lot of it has to do with economic inequality. Some of it has to do with corrupt governments and states, et cetera, and all of which is in Stephen's fine book. Every comment has to go back to the book, by the way. So, and the second point I want to just say, which again, we're kind of talking all around it, is that, you know, the U.S. isn't we're not kind of innocent here. I mean, we've often taken a short-term approach at the expense of long-term objectives that we should have focused on, right? And I think that was very much my experience in education of working on Pakistan, that it was the expedient approach was often the best one for the moment in time for the whatever political objective we had, or if it was even a security objective, you know, the shorter approach was often the one that all sides wanted to take, only to learn, you know, that a few years later, you know, we should have done something different, right? But the key is that we learned those lessons, and it would be prudent for the Trump administration to kind of take note of those. So, and I don't expect that short-term versus long-term theme to end. I think that's just a constant issue that you struggle with in policymaking. So one thing we alluded to, Josh, is transparency. Could you talk, all of you, I mean, but specifically, could you talk about what are the expectations of transparency kind of from the policy, or what should the public expect in terms of transparency and reporting from the U.S. government? Sometimes now I feel like we're like a lot of these partners that we've had where they don't really explain to their own people what the U.S. is doing in their countries, and we're just kind of learning from the headlines. So what should we expect, given that some of this information is very sensitive and it doesn't all need to be shared? And then the second bigger question for all of you is, and we've talked about this before as well, is are we continuing the CT fight indefinitely? What are the parameters for this kind of new kind of security environment that we found ourselves in after 9/11, and how sustainable is using things like, you know, direct action when there are bigger issues like cyber policy and the, you know, radicalization of folks, like just through the media and messaging from our own government and from the internet? So that's a big question. I don't think we're going to get the answer to, but would love your thoughts.
I'm happy to start if sure. you want. So I'll say a word on each of those. On the transparency point, I agree with you, and I guess to some extent I agree with the president that one doesn't want to show the enemy what one is about to do. That's not what anyone would recommend about military or other forms of action. But there's a whole lot of space to say a whole lot more than this administration is saying about counterterrorism that, in my experience, and I think in the experience of many others, doesn't sacrifice sensitive intelligence, doesn't sacrifice the element of surprise that one wants for military and other sorts of operations. And I think that's true both at the strategic level, which is why are strikes and the pace of them up in a place like Yemen or Somalia? It's hard to know whether one wants to criticize that, accept that, applaud that, if one doesn't understand the strategic context for it. What's the aim? What are the new, generally, types of actions that are being taken and towards what sustainable end? That's the sort of very high-level discussion, and even higher level of that, how does this administration think about counterterrorism? They have not, as Steve and I noted in a piece that I had the good fortune to work on with Steven, they have not put out a counterterrorism strategy. They did talk about counterterrorism in the national security strategy in some very traditional ways, and I don't mean that as a bad thing. If anything, probably a good thing. But it's hard to know when things do change, what to make of those changes if one doesn't have the strategic context for them. Then there's also a very granular, at the other side of the spectrum, type of information sharing that strikes me as responsible. And I know this is one that Luke feels strongly about as well, which is information purely on what we're doing after we've done it, not before we've done it, and in particular, whom it's killing, both in terms of combatants and non-combatants or civilians. This was something that the previous administration worked towards more slowly than some would like, but worked hard to at least say more about that, and by the end did so and entrenched that commitment in an executive order. Ultimately, Congress entrenched a related obligation on the Defense Department in a statute. And when the deadline for both of those rolled around just under a month ago, the deadline was simply ignored. The information wasn't there. And to tell the American people that sort of information, how much are we doing, mm-hmm. and whom are we killing when we do it? That strikes me after the fact as not just not harming things, but it generally is helpful to things, because often this government and those who implement its policies are incredibly careful in what they do, and it often helps to defang a narrative to the contrary, mm-hmm. to put out the information as best we have it. I have thoughts on your second question, but maybe I should pass it on for others to chime in on that.
Please. Yeah.
Sure. So the question of, like, where does this all go, and what does the strategy look like, I think is a really important and timely one. There's a few things that jump to my mind on this. You know, for at least the last 10 years, we've had a counterterrorism strategy across administrations that says we can't kill our way out of this. We can't overly militarize our responses to this. And yet, if you look at our expenditure of resources in a number of different ways, whether those are sort of policy, you know, actual financial or human resources, we're overwhelmingly focusing on the military and intelligence angles of what we do. One of the things that, you know, while it was very important to get the drone policy and the broader direct action policy right, and we spent a lot of time in the Obama administration convening senior level meetings to make sure it was being implemented in the way that the president wanted to, and that was very important. That ultimately has an opportunity cost associated with it as well, which is to say, you know, the real rubber meets the road on policymaking is at the deputies committee, the number twos of the departments and agencies across the U.S. government. And for every hour they're spending talking about a drone strike or proposed drone actions, that is an hour they're not talking about building partnership capacity, that they're not talking about things like dealing with terrorist use of encryption and other electronic communications methods, cyber, as Josh mentioned. Some of these really big either X factors or things that we've said from a strategic perspective that we think we have to get right if we want to have a fighting chance of really getting after the enemy. Secondly on this, when it comes to more direct uses of resources, not just the deputy's time, which is actually a very important resource, but actual financial resources, I just participated in a working group that the Stimson Center put out assessing the total expenditures and total cost of U.S. counterterrorism efforts since 9/11. And we concluded that over $2.8 trillion have been spent on in the name of counterterrorism. That includes the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, includes Homeland Security, includes a huge range of activities. And if you break those numbers down, the amount of that $2.8 trillion that was spent on foreign aid, that's to say any sort of development, that includes, you know, equipment for partner militaries, it includes countering violent extremism measures we might take in foreign countries, it's less than 1%. And if you count in the total cost of state and aid operations, so you kind of get these incredibly expensive deployments of diplomats to war zones, you still are under 5%. So, you know, we can say, we can talk about our strategy all we want. We can say that we're trying to not overly militarize it. But as an old professor of mine used to say, you know, don't listen to my speech, read my budget, because that's where I have to make some real decisions. And we have consistently emphasized the military tools. There are a lot of good reasons for that. They have to do with strictures that the Congress has placed on the administration, color of money issues, on, and we can certainly get into those. But to say that our strategy is balanced is just not borne out by actual analysis of what we've actually done.
Great. So let me sort of pick up that thread and go back to that question of how long are we in this for? Let me also say that, first of all, thank you guys for sort of the kind words. You all should just know, in the interest of transparency, if the book is good or it is better because Josh and Luke sort of spent, you know, long periods of time talking with me, you know, about a lot of the decisions they struggle with. So to the degree that I'm able to capture sort of that policy flavor, it's because I've talked to people, you know, who were doing policy making at the highest levels.
But rest assured that all errors remain the author.
They are all mine, yeah. In terms of your question about how long are we in this for, and there being other greater issues out there, I think the National Defense Strategy recognizes this. It says that counterterrorism will no longer be the guiding principle from a security perspective. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who's spent, you know, over 10 years working on terrorism, counterterrorism, I am in violent agreement with that. It should not be. But at the same time, I think it is naive to believe that we're going to sort of be able to put this behind us anytime soon. Terrorist threats will persist. And even if one believes that those terrorist threats are overblown, which I think in some cases they may be, policymakers and especially elected officials will feel the need to respond to them and will sometimes leverage them for their own purposes. And so I think, you know, we are likely to see an ongoing focus on counterterrorism, even if it is not the top security focus, for the foreseeable future. And I think there are several... Then consequences and assessments that flow from that. And the first is that we need to do counterterrorism more efficiently and effectively. And the Stimson Center project that, that Luke was part of, you know, the fact that we've spent $2.8 trillion is in and of itself, right, I think the sticker shock should be right there for everybody. But the Stimson Center then had to sort of go through, and I think you guys had to estimate in some cases what was or was not being spent, what was or was not counterterrorism. And so the fact that we don't know and that we can't do effective assessment, monitoring, and evaluation for where we're getting bang for our buck and where we're not getting bang for our buck needs to change. Because if we're going to be in this for the long term and we're not going to be able to spend like drunken sailors because we're looking at other at other issues that are going to be higher level, then we need to be more effective and efficient. And part of that, I think, means being harder on ourselves internally organizationally in terms of how we do CT strategy and planning and how we do evaluations. The other part, right, which we've talked a lot about, is how to get more out of our partners. And I think that goes to also knowing what we can expect from them. And Josh, I think your points about, you know, the Kurds on the ground and where that relationship is heading highlights two important factors. One is that it's not enough to share a threat. It's how you prioritize that threat relative to other threats. And now that the ISIS threat has declined, we're seeing, right, the Kurds are there are other greater issues for them. Same for the Turks, same for other actors. We're not going to be able to sort of get around that. I'm always very skeptical that you can change a partner's threat perceptions. But for that reason, I think the politics and the diplomacy become even more important. Can you change the Kurds' threat perceptions? No. Can you change the Saudis' threat perceptions? No. But good diplomacy can help mitigate some of the sort of worst case consequences that can come out of that. And that's, I think, what part of what's missing right now. And so then I would close with this, is there's, I think, two sides to the what should go under the CT bucket question. And, you know, in true academic form, I've got like a nice chart where I say, here are all the different things that I think go under CT cooperation. And I do believe that diplomacy is part of that. And if you don't, if you're not mindful of diplomacy as part of counterterrorism, then you run into problems. If you're not mindful of countering violent extremism as part of counterterrorism, then you run into problems. If you're not mindful of the fact that access or cooperation on detainees is part of counterterrorism, then you run into problems, especially when you're not mindful of the trade-offs that take place between those. The danger is that everything becomes counterterrorism. And I think that's where you know, sort of a very, very rigorous internal assessments become important. Because you need to be clear about where things fit in terms of the counterterrorism strategy and where they don't. That doesn't mean that everything is CT. It means you have to understand where CT runs up against other foreign policy issues. And I think that also gets to that point that you were making, Shamila, about the short-term, long-term trade-off. That's something that, right, that the Obama administration faced. It's a problem that the Bush administration faced. In other garb, it's a problem that the Clinton administration faced and Bush Sr. faced. And it's a problem that every administration faces. The Obama administration, and I think even the Bush administration to a degree, wrestled with those issues. And I think, Luke, you're absolutely right when you point to the spending on military and everything else. Sometimes maybe they didn't wrestle with them to the degree that which some of us might have liked. Maybe if they'd had a better sense of what they were going to get out of partnerships, they would have known where they could drive a harder bargain and be more long-term focused. I think the danger with the Trump administration is not that they're confronting the same challenges in terms of diplomacy and its importance or in terms of long-term, short-term. It's that I don't see them wrestling with these issues at the highest levels, right? So even if the Obama administration fell short, even if the Bush administration fell short, there's a cognizance of these challenges and wrestling with them as opposed to this sort of like, well, let's just try to kill our way out of this problem, right? Diplomacy is hard, let's not bother. The short term often takes precedence over the long term. Let's just focus on the military piece. That to me is one of the bigger issues, is that we're not wrestling with them. And so you're never going to get the perfect answer, but you can't optimize your CT, right, or you can't mitigate against the bad stuff if you're not wrestling with these things on a day in, day out basis.
Hmm. Very well said. Another thought to add to that is that CT policy can be very transactional if you mm-hmm. want it to be, and it our own policy has been. But we don't want to go down that path because it's not effective, right? Mm-hmm. And I think because the Trump administration is a very kind of transactional administration in everything, and I think that's one of the stated kind of objectives of, or it's a known approach of it, right? And so you can see that happening at commerce and you know within the military partnerships, and I think you can expect it in CT as well. And if that's what we are to presume of their policy, I think we're in for a lot of kind of cleaning up in mm-hmm. the future, right? So that if I were to describe it in any way, I would say it would be transactional. And one final point on budgets, I'm glad we brought this up. We don't, you know, I would just caution that we don't want to dismantle a bureaucratic infrastructure that now exists to mm-hmm. deal with CT that we didn't really have when 9/11 happened, right? And so there's a wealth of expertise and kind of knowledge in the bureaucracy we didn't have before. And now that the threat has shifted, there is a very natural tendency to say, okay, well, we need to clean this, mm-hmm. you know, let's dismantle this and focus on this part of the world. And I would hope that we've learned those lessons, that mm-hmm. we don't want to do that. And I think we all agree on that point. But it's just a note of caution as we watch, you know, the administration looking at where it can cut costs. And in some places, you know, for example, the State Department, you do need to actually mm-hmm. trim some fat, but it has to be done in a kind of very careful and thoughtful way. Because as we said, diplomacy is very critical to effective CT policy. So I think there's a lot of good work to be done in that space. So let's thank you all, to our panelists. Let's open up for some Q&A. Please identify yourself and state your affiliation, and please ask a question. Please, yes.
Kamran Bukhari, Center for Global Policy. So CT policy, has it shifted in the sense that we are now dealing with not your traditional terrorist threat? Mm-hmm. The terrorist entities have morphed into insurgent groups and from there into state actors. So if you guys, one of you guys can explain that, how has that changed CT policy? Is it still, I mean, is it now bigger than CT? Are we looking at a bigger enterprise than what we traditionally know as classic counterterrorism?
Yes. Yes, I think it's absolutely morphed. I think one of the issues that when people tend to think of counterterrorism, right, they tend to think of the nuts and bolts pieces of it, right? There's mechanics to this, law enforcement piece, military piece, and those are all still there. And I think we were actually talking in the right in the back beforehand that a lot of that is still, we've been doing that for a while, and that runs reasonably well, right? But as I think you've heard from the conversation, there's, right, you're dealing with warfighting organizations, you're dealing with non-state actors that can take and hold territory and govern territory for a considerable amount of time. Shamila was referencing some of those risk factors in terms of economic deprivation, you know, lack of rule of law, poor governance, things like that. We're talking about the importance of diplomacy when dealing not just with other states, but with other non-state actors in terms of Kurds. And so because of the nature of the threat is bigger, and because I think not just the nature of the threat is bigger, but that there are more factors that we recognize today are informing that threat, the nature of CT has changed. And that's not to say that the old pieces of counterterrorism are no longer important. And it's not to say that every time you go promote rule of law or do diplomacy or anything else that it has to have a counterterrorism piece. But it is to say that because the threat is bigger, because there are threats from state-supported non-state actors, because there are non-state actors that increasingly have access to weapons and technology that states enjoy because they are able to take and hold territory for long periods of time, because you're dealing with warfighting organizations that are able to sort of do propaganda at ISIS, right, on the level that states were able to do propaganda, you know, historically, you know, reaching mass audiences. Of course, your toolbox needs to get bigger. You need more instruments to deal with that. Doesn't mean that every instrument is always going to be a CT instrument, but it means that counterterrorism is going to touch on different components of the government, right? And so I agree wholeheartedly. You don't dismantle the bureaucracy. I think you do sort of try to get more out of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why you've seen that growth.
Yeah.
I'll just add one thing to that, which is that in a lot of ways, the counterterrorism apparatus that we have, which has been remarkably effective, is put in place and designed to prevent another 9/11 style attack, mm-hmm. right? That's when the investments were made. And Al-Qaeda and the way that Al-Qaeda operates, again, our bureaucracy is meant to address that. It's a shadowy membership-based group where organizations and individuals within the organization have in many cases known each other for decades. And so you have these sorts of things where, you know, Al-Shabaab and AQIM swear bayat to Al-Qaeda and Zawahiri or bin Laden says, you know, essentially let us think about it, right? And there's this long kind of period of courtship before they're actually allowed in as a full-scale entity. You have Al-Qaeda primarily operating in these shadowy web forums and kind of the under side of the web. And you have ISIS operating out in the wide open and operating actually a social media campaign and attempting to build a movement. And a movement that's not built on these long-term plots that can be devastating in the scale of 9/11, but that are also susceptible to disruption at multiple points, but rather these, you know, these homegrown violent extremist type threats. And on one issue after another, the US government is just not properly equipped to necessarily deal with these. Our dealing with the online threat is really difficult when we've got the First Amendment and we can't exactly go out and say this content, which we find offensive but doesn't break any laws, needs to be taken down. That's something we can't legally do. And even if we could, it'd be a hard thing to do given the ethos of our country. And so you can kind of tick through these things and ask yourself, are we really properly equipped for this threat, or is the bureaucracy, the and bureaucracies perhaps are pejorative, but the institutional capabilities we've built, can they be adapted to address to this new threat? And that is something that I hope this administration and really any administration would be dealing with at this point.
Just to add on quickly, the cycle you describe is the same one Mao said, every terrorist group wants to become an insurgency and every insurgency wants to become the state, and that's the classic cycle. So the question becomes, you know, are we seeing folks succeed in getting further down that cycle? And of course, there were groups that were able to hold territory before ISIS. There was the FARC, there was Boko Haram, but they didn't hold Mosul, they didn't hold Raqqa, they didn't hold as a whole territory the size of England. So there was something distinctive about ISIS and about the way it purported to govern, including taxing and doing all sorts of things for, very much for its own benefit, but to govern or to look like it was governing in a way and on a scale that was different. This in some ways then goes to the question earlier about sustainability of counterterrorism, because it is incredibly costly to do what we do in Yemen or what we do in Somalia. Maintaining the infrastructure to take strikes at the pace that the Obama administration was taking them or at the pace that the Trump administration is taking them, it costs a lot, but that's dwarfed by what the counter-ISIS campaign looked like at its peak in Iraq and Syria. It's dwarfed in just pure frequency and equipment involved and in dollars involved. And I think you get to that point where it begins to look particularly unsustainable if you have to do it again and again when a group has taken territory like that. Because that's what really, to dislodge a group from territory it's managed to take, it's really hard, it's really expensive, and it often requires military force, unlike some of the other ways you can intervene when it's more of a network operating but not holding territory. Which then asks the question, how do you make sure you don't have to go back and do it again? And how do you stop the next group from being able to go down that Mao cycle from the aspiring terrorist group to the next purported state or proto-state or quasi-state or whatever ISIS was? And that the answer to that comes before the military tool gets involved, and it's where you hope there are the type of deliberations that Stephen was mentioning earlier that I'm not sure we are seeing right now, but that are critical if you don't want to be stuck fighting these sorts of fights over and over again.
My name is Sabah Shahan, and I'm with the Voice of America, and my question is that if you could put in a nutshell the policy and the change, you know, in the spending from Obama, Bush to Obama to Trump administration, and you spoke about accountability, transparency. So, do you see any accountability efforts in words?
In terms of accountability and assessment, so the NDAA mandated that the Department of Defense has to do assessment, monitoring, and evaluation for all security cooperation and assistance programs. That's not just specific to counterterrorism. That means anytime the United States is providing security assistance to a ally or partner, or it's doing training or other types of cooperation, military exercises, things of that nature, that there needs to be assessment, monitoring, and evaluation. And DOD set up an office that was working on putting all of that in place. That work continues, right? There are, it is a massive undertaking. There are debates about how to do it. There has been some good work in terms of applying best practices. There's ongoing debates about how much to spend on that, right? Like the international best practices, you spend 3% of your budget. Nobody wants to spend, right, in government 3% of their budget on AM&E. So that's ongoing. The other, I would just mention the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, at least earlier this year, I understood to be looking at a similar mandate for the State Department, in part because of the acknowledgement that, state just needs to be measuring as well, and in part, I think, out of concerns that the Department of Defense and the military is already so far out in front, in so many ways, in terms of driving our policy, that to now have them being so far out in front in terms of assessing, monitoring, and evaluating how this is being used, and state to not have that capacity could further drive, further widen that gap between each department's capabilities.
I think in terms of the question of going from the Bush administration to the Obama administration to the early Trump budgets, there's a couple of trends that emerge. First of all, that the initial big investments were made into the Bush administration. And it's helpful to maybe split this into sort of the standing homeland security intel type apparatus we need to keep us safe on a steady state versus the incremental costs of the wars, particularly Iraq, Afghanistan, and to a somewhat lesser extent, Iraq and Syria. And you have these massive investments after 9/11 in creating the Department of Homeland Security and creating the Director of National Intelligence. I think most people who track this field would feel like those were largely prudent investments, although certainly a case can be made that we could spend more or less on Homeland Security in the particulars and achieve similar outcomes. The one that has been tricky to rein in has been the cost of the wars. And it's been difficult for a number of reasons. Early on, the Bush administration didn't want to put a real price tag on some of that. Some of that, I think they didn't know exactly what it was going to be. In other cases, I think they wanted to lowball to the public the total cost of those wars. And so we did these emergency supplementals that would come up every 6 months, then every year. Mm-hmm. And the Obama administration tried to put some discipline around that by creating the overseas contingency operation label to account for all of that war spending. And there were specific criteria for what you could put into that budget and what you couldn't. So things that we saw early on happening, like, the Army and the Marine Corps saying, there have been these modernizations and updates to tanks that we've wanted to do for years, and we didn't have the budget for it. So when we bring the tank back from Iraq or Afghanistan, let's just go ahead and do that upgrade while we're at it, and we'll fund it out of the war spending. Those sorts of things that really caused the war spending to be bloated beyond probably what were the real costs of it have largely been cut out and put away. And some of that is because the imposition of criteria, and some of that is because we're just spending a lot less money in those theaters to begin with. And I think that's good. I think it's good to have some of that rigor around the budget. And I think it's also good for us to have some honest conversations about, does it make sense to have so much of the Special Operations Command's budget in the OCO account, in that sort of supplemental account? We're going to need SOCOM at its current end strength for the foreseeable future, for counterterrorism, for counterproliferation, for a huge range of asymmetric threats. And we shouldn't be saying that that's a supplemental budget that could go away at some point in the future. I think with the Trump administration, it's hard to tell because there have been these kind of irresponsible skinny budgets that are released that it's hard to tell how serious of a policy document those are versus just an attempt to make a strong case about fiscal austerity. And in many cases, it's involved dramatic slashes to the State Department's budget, increases to the Pentagon budget, although not always clear that it's in the most strategic way. And then Congress takes a pretty active role in kind of reshaping it into what they think it ought to look like. And so, I haven't seen a really frank and I think honest budget conversation with this administration yet that really lays out our resources and how they're going to help us accomplish a range of national security objectives, including but not limited to counterterrorism.
Okay.
I got nothing to add.
Good. All right. Thank you. Yeah, let's take two final questions. We just have 5 minutes. So these two folks here.
Thank you very much for very nice presentations. My name is Peter Sverin. I'm from the Russian Embassy. As you said, the terrorism, it's a global threat, and as it was mentioned several times by the representatives of the administration, no one country can fight it alone. Russia has suggested to establish a global front to fight against terrorism, and it's still the goal. But I would like you to just think out loud a bit about the what countries the U.S. must cooperate with so to raise the effectiveness of counterterrorism measures. Thanks a lot.
Okay, and then this woman over here.
Kelly Blahos, the American Conservative Magazine. Just a contextual question. We know, and you had mentioned that the number of drone strikes had gone up exponentially from Obama to Bush. I think it's in the 50s. For Bush, and then I think Obama, it was like 565. We didn't get those numbers officially until the end of the Obama administration. Do we get any sense of whether or not there's been an escalation in direct action, or are we still waiting for some official numbers? You mentioned the NDAA mandate, but do we have a sense of if we're talking about an increase in direct action, or is everything just speculative at this point? Under Trump.
I'll jump on that one first. So I think that, so first of all, the administration hasn't released its comprehensive roll-up, sort of the aggregate statistics of actions across the areas outside of active hostilities. That said, in some cases, the Pentagon has released specific numbers. And then there are three really good outside organizations that track drone strikes, New America being one of them. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London is very good as well, as is the Long War Journal housed over at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. So pretty good bipartisan type trackers there. The numbers have definitely gone up outside of areas of active hostilities. If you just look at the Pentagon's actual released numbers for Yemen, it's 120 this year, and I think last year it was in the range of 40 to 50 or something like that, last year being 2016 versus 2017. So the final year of the Obama administration, you're in the 40 to 50 range, if I recall correctly, and then 120 in the first year of the Trump administration. And the numbers reported by those three organizations I mentioned show increases in Somalia, and I don't remember exactly how the other theaters shake out, but the aggregate would be almost certainly higher. They also show somewhat higher civilian casualties. Those are hard to assess without any context around them. Which is to say, in some of the cases in Yemen and Somalia, it appears that our strikes may have been in support of partner nation ground forces. If that were the case, they might not have been abiding by the same rules of near certainty of no civilian casualties. And so you might expect some higher levels of civilian casualties. That's why that context around it, I think, is so important. And I'd be hesitant to sort of make any absolute statements about that in the meantime. And I'll just take a brief stab at the question on what CT partners we should be working with. I think the answer from my perspective is all of them, right? In the sense that I think we too often, when we think about partnerships, think about how do we help a country that is facing a terrorist threat within its own borders build the capabilities it needs. But we also need to be thinking about our traditional allies. We need to be thinking about regional partners. We need to be thinking about multinational organizations. And there are various case studies of these where each one of them, whether it's the French in Africa or the AMISOM mission in Somalia, being incredibly effective against some of our shared threats. You guys jump in.
Okay, go ahead. I think Luke nailed it on the numbers. I'm not sure I have much to add on that. In terms of partners, you know, I sort of begin where Luke does in terms of canvassing what's out there. Often we go into counterterrorism endeavors with partners most readily available who are a lot like us. So we begin with Western European countries that are not geographically proximate to wherever we're worried about the threat emerging from, who have capabilities similar to ours. In a lot of ways, ours are often superior or at least greater in number. But we go in with similar folks, and that's not exactly what you need. That's not to, in any way to shake a stick at the wonderful partners we have, but sometimes you need people who are simply the partners where the problem is emerging from or those with different capabilities. And sometimes that can get harder because you want to engage in this effort with those who share a certain commitment to the law of armed conflict and to policies about ensuring that there's an appropriate respect for at least attempts to avoid civilian casualties. You never can guarantee that you won't have them. And that's where I think partnerships can get more difficult, both with those whom we often call the host countries, the countries from whose soil the terrorism threat emanates, and from others who may be active there. And ultimately, if you find a partner who who's not meeting those thresholds that we consider either legally or just morally appropriate, it then becomes quite difficult to figure out how to navigate that and either point them in a direction that makes them suitable as a partner, if they're open to that, or figure out how to deal with the situation without that. But there is this tricky balance between needing to work with partners who aren't like us, because that they often have things that we don't have, including sheer proximity, and at the same time adhering to the values that we both believe in because we believe in, but also because we think they're important for counterterrorism and for maintaining the moral high ground that counterterrorism requires.
Yeah, I would just briefly add on the numbers, right? When you look at aggregate, that we've talked a lot, that there has been the increase in Yemen and in Somalia. I think I looked at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism not too long ago, and it looks like there was the Somalia had at least doubled in 2017 over 2016. There's also questions about whether strikes are being reported as, right, it might be that you'll have five strikes, but it's reported as one strike because it was in the same location or something like that. So there's questions about how the reporting. But I would also point out that, unless I'm mistaken, strikes in Pakistan have come down considerably from the high point. And so that, right, you're going to see more in places like Yemen and Somalia, fewer in places like Pakistan. And so that will sort of impact what the aggregate number looks like as well. I think it's worth keeping in mind that strikes in Pakistan were partially intended for degrading al-Qaeda, were also partially intended for force protection for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, whereas now, as Luke was mentioning, in places like Yemen, it may be force protection for partner forces rather than necessarily for U.S. forces. So just sort of put some context around those numbers. On the issue of partners that we work with, I'm in agreement with Josh that, right, I think there's an important importance of looking both at who our close allies are, that sometimes are our natural partners or natural allies, and also places where we're going to need to work with somebody because that's where the threat is. But I would add on another piece to that, which is I think often when we look at partnerships and what we want out of our partners, we tend to come at it very much from sort of what is the threat and what is it that we think that we need. And I would argue, and one of the things I do try to argue, right, is that the United States would do well to be more cognizant of what it can actually expect from its partners. Mm-hmm. So not to what we need from you and what do we want from you, because it's nice to want, right? But what can we actually expect from you? And I think that's where you then get into not just what is that partner's capability and capacity, but also what other threats does it face? What else do we have going on with that partner when it comes to foreign policy, right? Are we potentially competing in other places and trying to cooperate on counterterrorism, or are things sort of benign outside of CT, or do we have a pre-existing relationship with you for other reasons? Those are all questions that I think, individual policymakers, certainly that I've spoken to, pay attention to, but collectively as the policymaking community, we could potentially put more emphasis on.
Wonderful. Well, thank you everyone for joining us in these great questions, and please join me in thanking our panelists for a great conversation. Thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Special thanks this week to everyone at New America who helped us run this episode. Our editor is Jen Patya Howell, and our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.